I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, pushing the boundaries of scientific discovery can frequently require trekking through some of the most remote and dangerous parts of the planet. There still are parts of the world that have been untouched and are waiting to provide answers to some of the biggest questions. Neil Shubin has been to some of those spots in the Arctic and Antarctic, facing polar storms and challenging the limits of human endurance to find out how life survived, adapted, and then thrived. And now at those polar extremes, there are drastic environmental changes and political battles who will exploit the now available minerals and at what cost. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Picture in your mind's eye that iconic cartoon image of evolution that frequently has the creature making its first moves from water to land. It's a clumsy, kind of a goofy-looking fish that struggles and finally makes its way onto land, and that is a monumental moment in the history of life on the planet. That fish-like creature is actually a Tiktaalik, and Neil Shubin and his team discovered its fossil, and they found that its fins eventually did turn into our wrists, and that's how we got our limbs. Neil's latest book is Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. And Neil, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me here.
So before we get into all this incredible research and adventures that you've had on the polar regions and what's happening with all that, I want to ask you about what's happening with the federal government hitting pause on scientific research on these grants, federal research grants. You're a scientist, you're well-established, well-known, scientific communicator. What can you tell us what you have heard about what's happening with the pause that we've gotten from the White House on these scientific grants?
Well, there are two things that are happening. The first is great uncertainty, and that uncertainty really translates into a pause in recruiting, because anytime you have uncertainty in funding, uncertainty in the sort of the political situation, you have challenges in recruiting people into the scientific workforce and developing a effective and competitive scientific workforce. It takes time, you know, and when you hit the pause button, you can really disrupt things that have been in process for years. But the other thing that's happened is on Friday night, the after the news cycle ended, the National Institutes of Health announced dramatic reductions. I mean, some institutions will get reduced by $90 million a year. And these are medical systems, academic medical systems, of which I work in one. And these will affect, you know, sort of the basic research and applied research that affects human health. You know, it's a simple matter. The less you support something, the less you'll have of it. And the it we're talking about is research that affects human health, human well-being, and our nation's competitiveness on the international scale. Our competitors aren't cutting, competitor nations aren't cutting back, but we are, unfortunately. And that's going to have long-term effects on all of us, regardless of your political persuasion.
The reporting has it that this freeze on funding for biomedical research is stopping some research in cancer and other critical diseases that are like underway right now. Some people have medical devices in them that are being tested, and they're stuck with them until these freezes are unfrozen.
That's correct. Now, we do have – there's a court order that's put a pause on that freeze, but that in what we're talking about is research that, you know, affects human health, and it's clinical trials of new cancer treatments. It's heart disease, and it's the diagnosis and treatment of heart disease. It's kidney disorders, neurodegenerative diseases. These are things we've all, deal with in our own lives, our own families, our own friends. And, you know, the United States has led the world in the scientific enterprise for decades, and that is translated into a small and large businesses that have launched from these things, and it's translated into things that make a difference for our human well-being and our health. And we stand to lose a lot of that if we discontinue funding. So, yeah, we're in a fairly uncertain and in some cases urgent situation in the scientific fields.
And the January 27th White House memo that began this freeze, the logic behind that memo is saying they wanted to take a look at DEI and woke stuff that was happening in this research. What is that? Do you know? Any idea?
Well, I mean, it's been a bit of a whipsaw. So, I mean, we've in the last previous administration, there were edicts to expand the diversity of the workforce and expand the infrastructure and administration around that. And institutions followed suit. And now there is a push to remove all that. And it's specifically to remove it in trying to engage different populations in the scientific enterprise. As I say, it's uncertainty. It's been whipsawing back and forth in each direction in the last 5 years for us.
Well, what about your research, the work that you have done and that you want to do going forward? I mean, I don't think you could have made these, correct me if I'm wrong, you could have made these discoveries, gone on these expeditions without scientific grants.
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, it costs money to work in Antarctica and the Arctic. Now, we raise substantial amounts of private support, but the infrastructure that we use, the microscopes, the offices, the lab buildings, many of the devices that we use, the aircraft that we use, that's all from federal support. In some cases, it's United States federal support. In other cases, it's Canadian federal support when we work up in the Canadian Arctic. In some cases, it was even Danish or Greenlandic support. But no, we rely on the support of nations. Mostly, it's our own nation, of course, to do our work. Yeah, absolutely. Doesn't happen without it.
In your book, your latest book, Ends of the Earth, which is really cool because it takes you inside. I've always wanted to. It's like, I wonder if I could do that, go up on those Arctic expeditions and live in those conditions for a while. Are those people okay? Are they going to be stranded who live in those permanent encampments?
No, I mean, I think, whenever there's a government shutdown, what happens is, and we're not in a shutdown right now, but when there are government shutdowns, they do evacuate people from the field. Now, it costs the government enormous amounts of money to remove people and urgently like that. We're not in that situation at the current time, but that's something that has happened in the past, particularly about 10 years ago. About 2011 is the last time it happened.
Right. So, but there is a concern about the freezing of the funds for what kind of work goes on up there that could be impacted by the freezing of funds?
Well, working all the work on glaciers. I mean, if you freeze funds to Antarctic research, we lose our information.
But don't they always have frozen funds? Just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. They're the coldest of all funds, I guess. What's happening with glaciers and what's happening with sea level and how that affects our lives, all these things will be impacted by that, from basic to applied science. I mean, from the science that, where we devise robots that can probe under the ice or robots that can probe outside in other parts of the solar system. These are all would be affected by freeze and funding.
And this is a critical time as we're seeing the effects of climate change really showing its hand in these extremes, polar extremes, and what's happening with the ice and what's being revealed by the melting of the ice. So we're going to be talking about that and get into the research and your discoveries, particularly about this fish that you found with your team that showed that that fins eventually did turn into our limbs. And our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment for our guest, Neil Shubin, he is the author of Ends of the Earth. And you can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, about science, about the polars, about what's Greenland. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For over three decades, scientist Neil Shubin has been making extraordinary discoveries by leading scientific expeditions to the sweeping ice landscapes of the Arctic and Antarctic. He has survived polar storms and faced the limits of human endurance to explore questions of how life survived, adapted, and thrived, and what is the future on this changing planet. You can call in, ask Neil a question. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Neil, tell me about this fossil that you came up with, you came across, the Tiktaalik. Is it Tiktaalik rosae? Is that how I would say that?
You got it. Yeah, you win the prize. You pronounced it right.
Okay. Well, it's not a wine. It's a rock fish thing. What about it? What is it?
What it is it's a fish. If I was to hold it in front of you, it's a fossil fish, about 4 feet long. It's from rocks that are dated around 375 to 380 million years old. And if you were to look at it, you'd say, well, you know, it looks like a fish. It's got scales on its back and fins with fin webbing. But then you'd look at it and say, wait a minute, it has a crocodile-like head. It has a neck. No fish has a neck. And when you look inside the fin, it has bones that correspond to our upper arm, our forearm, even parts of our wrist. This is a fish with a shoulder, elbow, and a wrist. And it has a leg as well. It has lungs and gills. So it's a creature that's right at the cusp of the great transition in life from water to land, one of the first fish to walk on land. And honestly, the story of it that I think I find the most fun to tell is that we didn't just happen on it. It took us 6 years to find it working in Canada's Ellesmere Island. We worked up there because the rocks looked right. They were the right age and the right type. But we had to figure out how to work in Earth's polar regions. We had to figure out how to do all this stuff, working hundreds of miles from the nearest base, you know, where there are polar bears around. I mean, there are real struggles here. So the story is as much about the fossil as it is the way we found it. And that's kind of what led to my book here, which is Ends of the Earth, which was really doing science in the polar regions changes the way we see the world, changes the way we see ourselves, changes the way we see the cosmos, changes the way we see our future. And I wanted to tell the stories of all the scientists working there. So it was a great privilege.
Yeah. So your new book, Ends of the Earth, it seems to be more about the men and women that live for the science and live for the challenges of working in those polar extremes.
Yeah, I've been so privileged to be part of the scientific community working in the Arctic and Antarctica. It's an amazing bunch of people working on glaciers, on oceans, on ecology, robots, satellites, and they are changing the way we see the world. And I wanted to tell their story. And it's a story that goes back over a century or more to explorers who tried to work in these regions, many of them tragically, honestly. And it's a story loaded with learning about the world by accident, by design, sometimes with tragedy, sometimes by serendipity. It's the human experience of learning about our world and discovering that I wanted to touch on in this book, because I've had the privilege of a scientist that's actually doing it. You know, leading expeditions for a number of years, not always successfully, mind you, but learning from those failures. And, you know, that's all part of this.
So back to the Tiktaalik fossil that you found. So when a fish evolves, or whatever animal evolves, because they're looking for a survival advantage.
Yeah, what happened about 380 million years ago or so was you had a series of fish living in the water, and the water was a very hostile place. There were a lot of predators there. On land, there were no predators, but there was food. There were invertebrates and things like that. So any sort of change that would allow creatures to leave the water and go towards land would be favored. And this one branch of fish, this which you mentioned, the Tiktaalik rosae, they're the ones that were able to walk. They were able to swim. So they were amphibious. They had fins, but they also had limb bones inside, meaning they can support themselves. They had lungs and gills, meaning they could breathe in air, but also breathe in water. So they were beginning to make these changes, and they didn't have fingers and toes yet. So it's not till a little bit later in the fossil record that we actually find amphibians with fingers and toes. But they built on the changes that creatures like Tiktaalik rosae had, you know, several million years before them.
But you're also looking at the genetic changes.
That's right. We look, my lab looks at the DNA involved in the changes as well. So we can ask a really amazing question. Like, we can ask, how does the DNA of a human differ from the DNA of a fish? And I can, you know, take my DNA or your DNA, we could look at it, and we could look at a fish, and we can compare and contrast it, and we can find similarities and differences. But what will blow your mind, and has, as it has blown mine, is that the similarities between our DNA and the DNA of fish are remarkable. Many of the genes that are used to make our limbs during embryonic development are seen in fish. And guess what they're doing? They're being used to make their fins. It's really small changes to these things.
So like mutations in the HOX gene, is that what you say?
Yeah, and not, yeah, exactly. And they're not, and there are certain kinds of genes. The HOX are one set of them that help build bodies. And it's been really remarkable because you can look at these genes and you can ask, how are they different between, you know, fish and people? And frogs and birds. And you can begin to ask at the genetic level what makes things similar, what makes them different. And what you find when you do this is that we share so much with these creatures. And that the changes are often fairly, you know, less than you'd think genetically. Because small genetic changes can have very big effects on anatomy.
But 375 million years ago, this is when this was happening. This is when the fish got out of the ocean. I remember seeing these giant scorpions. Is that what they're running from?
Oh man, yeah, they're called Eurypterids. They're like lobsters, like 6 foot long lobsters. You want to run away from those things? Yeah, definitely. They're in the fossil record. Yeah,
yeah. So that's what they're running away from. And so they get onto the land. And what's on the land for them? I mean, do they just
is it
like a lifeboat for them, or do they really try to conquer the land?
I think an oasis is more like it, right? You have trees, you have shrubs, you had soil, you had all kinds of plants there, ferns, things like that. And then living in the plants were in large invertebrates, spider-like creatures, you know, worms and things like that, which are food sources as well. But they're not food sources that would eat, you know, another fish, right? So what you had on land was a landscape that was rich in food but didn't have a whole lot of competitors for fish. Or predators. So the fish could eventually walk on land actually entered a new world. They were free of all that bad stuff.
And so what fossil record do we have of all that? And was this the only place on the planet, this isolated part of Canada way up north, the Great White North, where you have that the rocks sticking out, that you're able to find this fossil? Or if you looked elsewhere, now that you know what to look for, you could find it?
Yeah, that's the thing. Once you see it everywhere. And so, no, we have a very good record of these things now. We have over 20 specimens of Tiktaalik rosea, but that's not the only species out there. Other colleagues have discovered them in Eastern Europe. They're from Quebec in Canada. They're from other places as well. So we're getting a really good glimpse of what's happening at this time period. And there are rocks in Greenland. There are rocks in Antarctica. There are rocks in Australia, which are also showing aspects of these changes as well. So it's been a real global hunt for these things. And actually, the hunt has led us, my team, from Ellesmere Island and Greenland, which is up in the north, to Antarctica as well, where we continued our search.
Well, aren't these fossils typically named after the location where they're first found? Why isn't it called Ellesmere fossil?
Well, yeah, we wanted to reference a donor who helped support our research.
Oh, that's always a good idea.
And the name Tiktaalik, we wanted to work with the Inuit community up there, the indigenous people who live up there, and they were the ones who supported our research locally. There was a community about 300 miles away. We wanted to have a naming project, and so they named it actually. So we wanted a name that reflected, the continuity to the local residents. And typically, yeah, you will use when you news a new species is described, you might have a name that reflects its geography. So we found another Tiktaalik-like creature, and we named it after the region, which is Kikatania, and it's an Inuit word. For the location where we found it, so yeah, we do the location as well. You know,
so how long did
again we? I'm sorry.
How long did Tiktaalik roam the? I don't know, the mud flats.
Yeah, probably about a million years or so, and so until it was replaced by others. But it did go extinct. It obviously no longer lives. It has. There are living relatives that are look a little bit different. So lungfish, which are alive today, are cousins of Tiktaalik. They're fish with both gills and lungs, and they actually have one little arm bone buried in their fins.
Right, and they will crawl out of the mud and into and move around a bit.
Yeah, you can see them at Aquaria today, actually, doing their thing.
And so how big of a deal was this transition from sea to land?
Well, it changed everything, right? I mean, it changed everything because if you look at the creatures that are derived from that transition, it's mammals, it's reptiles, it's amphibians, it's birds. Over time, a whole tree of life emerged on that. I mean, that was a big event in our past. So if you look at our own bodies, we can see hints of this change from 380 million years ago. Every time you bend your wrist, every time you bend your neck, you can thank these creatures evolving in the late Devonian period, 380 million years ago.
I can't help but think it maybe because of my age, but I can't think about my hips. I mean, what did it have for hips?
They had hips. They had true hips. They had a pelvis, and they had a hip bone. They had a femur. I mean, these are fish with big pieces of our own body inside. So when we look at our own bodies, we can see similarities to some of these creatures evolving 380 million years ago.
But, you know, it didn't just develop these features overnight. It had its own evolution.
Absolutely. You can trace these things. I mean, this is a big step in it, the Tiktaalik piece, but we can actually trace some of these, the antecedents of it, even deeper in time. Yeah. So it's been a real detective story to see these changes in different fossils. It's really not just one, it's multiple. And we can begin to see how our body was constructed over time. What we're talking about here is that part of our history when our distant ancestors were fish.
And how does it become, take on all the, so it wasn't an evolutionary dead end. That's one thing I worry, so, oh, things, something will develop, it will change, there'll be a mutation, but it doesn't go anywhere. But somehow the circumstances allowed it developed into other species.
Yeah, well, its cousins developed into other species, and they developed limbs with digits, fingers and toes. And their descendants developed, you know, an egg where they can survive on land. So it's a series of small changes over time that led to the world we'd see today. But the world that existed inside the rocks of this polar region years ago was one that was contained some of the first terrestrial ecosystems, some of the first land ecosystems with creatures actually walking and living on land.
And then there were some land animals that went back into the sea and became whales, dolphins, and things like that.
Yeah, that was like 50 million years ago. So that's almost 330 million years later after this change.
But it's interesting how that
to do a U-turn.
Yeah, so well, maybe we should go back to the water. Pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, creatures are opportunistic. Evolution's opportunistic. So, you know, it depends on the local environment and the local adaptations. And so yeah, whales and, you know, cetaceans went back in the water.
So this 2006 announcement that you found this fish that led to our limbs and this great evolutionary journey beginning. That was a huge deal.
It was. At the time, it was a very big deal for us as a team. You know, remember, it's a team that's involved in these things. And what it did is it really spurred us on because, you know, we were failures for 5 years before the announcement, right? So, you know, I told you this is a 6-year hunt. So 5 of those years were like we'd come back and like shrug.
Well, this was like your last gasp, wasn't it? It's like we have enough money for one more trip.
We're done. In fact, we barely had enough. We had kind of we soaked it out. It was going to be credit cards after that point. And then, then we found it in the last year. And
some guy says, "Hey, look at this rock. What do you think?"
Well, it was kind of what happened. Yeah, this is my colleague Steve. We're working on a layer of rocks that had bones in them. And we weren't finding anything really new in that layer. But my colleague Steve said, "Hey, guys, what's this?" And I ran over, and as soon as I saw it, I knew we had, you know, the fish.
You knew what you were looking for, and there it was. We're going to take a break now. We're going to continue our discussion with Neil Shubin. His latest book is Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. We're going to dig into his latest book about how they do this scientific research, how they manage to deal with extreme cold in the extreme parts of the planet, and what's happening in these places as well as the planet is heating up. You can ask your questions and give your comments. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Scientific discoveries at the Earth's polar regions are changing the way that we see the world, and these insights are becoming all the more urgent. These landscapes are the epicenter for the rapidly changing planet as it heats up. Ice is retreating, and animal species are trying to figure out ways to survive, or they will go extinct. And indigenous communities are being confronted by dramatic environmental changes. We're being joined by Neil Shubin. His book is Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. So, Neil, your new book, you start off by taking a trip to Greenland about 30 years ago. You've been going up there for a while. I wonder, have you noticed changes in the quality of this ice and snow and how things are warming up in all the years that you've been going to these polar regions?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the first things that hits you. And to give you a sort of a vivid example, we had worked there this past July in Ellesmere Island. And to prepare for this year's expedition, I dug out aerial photos taken by the Canadian American governments back in the late 1950s and early 1960s during the Cold War. And they would fly over these areas, take detailed pictures because they were thinking of, you know, military operations there. And those were public. Those are now publicly available, of course. And then I was comparing those older photos taken from the early 60s, late 50s to satellite photos taken in, you know, May of this year. And the amount of retreat of the ice that you can see in the areas we work is dramatic. I mean, glaciers have retreated, you know, over, you know, half a mile. And what that means is, of course, is those glaciers retreat, you now have bedrock that's exposed at the surface. And that's what we work on, you know, as geologists and paleontologists. But as that, but that rock is warmer. So what's happened is that as you get melting of ice, the Arctic itself heats up even more because you get the darker rocks that, you know, that radiate heat.
And yeah, the sunlight, so when it hits the white ice, it will reflect. But if it's the dark,
yes,
rock, igneous rock, then it'll warm up.
Yeah, you lose that reflectance, so it warms up. And, you know, the Arctic is heating by, you know, we can measure it from ground stations or from satellites, all the above. And it's heating about 4 to 7 times faster than the rest of the planet. And it's really noticeable on the ground. And it's definitely noticeable with the kinds of creatures you have up there. I mean, killer whales are now the dominant predator in the Arctic, not polar bears. In fact, killer whales are bringing about the extinction of narwhals because they are, you know, killer whales are effective predators, and narwhals are, you know, beautiful animals, but they don't easily defend themselves. So, you know, you've introduced new predators from the south to the north. So you're seeing lots of changes. You see changes of the animals, you see changes in the plants, you see changes in the ice. Now, in Antarctica, the situation is a little different. When you go to Antarctica, remember, that is a continent. It's larger than the continental United States. So when you look at the ice in the center of the continent of Antarctica, it's actually not shrinking. It's in places, it's actually growing. Where the change is happening in Antarctica, and it's most noticeable, is the ice that's along the margin of the – along the coast, where the ice meets the seawater, meets the ocean. And it's in those places where the changes are most noticeable.
And why is the ice building there?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. What happens is when you – so this – and one of the great stories I tell in the book is of the science to know this. Like satellites can look at the movement of ice. They can measure it by about a millimeter. That with that level of detail from the air, from space. And when they do that, they find that the ice normally and naturally moves in Antarctica from the center of the continent to the coasts. You know, think of it like, you know, how you see rivers extending from the continental divide on either direction. Well, here you essentially have the rivers flowing like, I mean, ice rivers, if you will, flowing from the center to the coast. Now, at the margin, at the coast, there are glaciers that are holding back that ice from entering the ocean, entering the sea. But the problem is this. As that ice meets the warmer seawaters, that ice melts. And if we lose that ice, and which is what folks are very concerned about, then you will have nothing stopping the ice from moving from the center of the continent to the ocean, which is a natural process, but it's been speeding up quite a bit. That ice is now moving at about, in some places, over, you know, a kilometer, half a mile a year.
Now, of the ice that we have locked in at these polar regions, that's about 70% of the fresh water that we have on the planet. The concern is that if we continue to have this melting, and that's what the science tells us is going to happen, that we're going to be dumping a lot of fresh water into the oceans. That's going to change the density of the water in the oceans and also raise sea levels. And that will be catastrophic for global weather patterns.
Yeah, that's it's undeniable. I mean, and we can actually measure that. Those satellites that are very refined can tell you. So we're losing about, in Greenland, we're losing about 252 gigatons of ice per year. It's melting from ice to water and going in the ocean. In Antarctica, it's about the same. Now, the numbers for those, you know, about 20 years ago were about 40. So it's, you know, it's increased about almost sixfold in about 25 years, which is an enormous amount of ice that's entering the oceans. Now, as that water, that fresh water enters the ocean, what it does is, you say, it changed it. And so it changes the level of the seas, right? So you can expect sea level to rise, and it already is in places. You can expect the currents of the ocean to change over time, certainly.
Right, the global the conveyor belt of temperature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the oceans move heat around on the planet. So as you change that, what you're changing is local weather patterns. And it can change everything from, you know, you can change coastlines geographically by changing the sea level, but you can also change weather patterns, agricultural belts, political boundaries, and so forth. These all depend quite finally on the level of the seas and what's happening in the seas. And those are changing. Now, what we don't know, what's harder to know, is what's going to happen in the future. We can tell you really with great detail what happened in the past and what's happening now. But the question is, can we predict what that's going to look like in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years? That's where it gets a little trickier. The scenarios range from very dire to a lot less dire. I think the current scenarios are, if we keep global temperatures the same as they are nowadays, we'll see probably about a foot of sea level rise by the end of the century.
But that we're can taking vary a lot. We're taking our foot off the brakes right now.
Totally.
What we did have is now going away. And the predictions are, in less than 50 years, Miami-Dade will be underwater. Galveston will be underwater.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. If you just put it as a foot a year, that's going to change so much, right? It'll change Miami. It'll change New Orleans. It'll change Louisiana. It'll change the coast of Texas. It'll change the coast of Africa and
We're
Asia.
Talking about in our lifetimes. I don't plan on living that long, but sure.
Yeah, we're talking about changes to Pacific Islands, which will disappear. We're talking about changes of political boundaries, because some of these areas are very, very, very hotly contested. We're dealing with real change here. What we don't know is there are some scenarios that say, well, maybe we'll get 10 feet of, you know, sea level rise. Those are very dire. I mean, and there's others that say, you know, 6 inches, which is still pretty bad, which is still pretty challenging for us. So, you know, any way you go, we're going to be witnessing sea level. The question for scientists is just how much.
Now, Greenland, you know, you've been there quite a bit. You've been eyes on Greenland. And now we have President Donald Trump. He wants to get his hands on Greenland. He wants to make it part of the United States. Everything that he wants to accomplish militarily, national security-wise, he's able to do now because of the treaties and the cooperation that we've had with Denmark and with Greenland. To be clear, even with these changes, with climate change and global warming and the melting of the ice in Greenland, it still seems to be kind of a miserable place, isn't it?
Yes, but it's one of the most beautiful places I've
ever
been.
I'm sure it's beautiful, but, you know, it's not going to be like a beautiful place to go vacation.
Oh, no, I don't think, you know, unless you're like a wilderness vacation kind of person. But it's in the places we work are much like the American Southwest.
I mean, it's no golf course there, right?
No, but I mean, imagine like Monument Valley with glaciers. I mean, that's the kind of beauty you're dealing with.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible, but yeah, you're not going to go, you know, it's not going to be a Bedford golf course or anything like that. But, you know, Greenland is at the center of a huge political struggle right now, and that's not getting reported. And the idea and the central piece is, if you look at the North Pole, remove the ice over the North Pole, what you have is seafloor. And there's a mountain range that extends from Siberia to Greenland and Canada. It's called the Lomonosov Ridge. It extends over, you know, over 1,000 miles. Well, it turns out the rocks in there look like historically they were part of Siberia at one point, part of Greenland at another point, and part of Canada at yet another, which means each country can claim the entire C4, an area about 2 to 3 times the size of Texas, as their own, as part of the law of the sea. So Greenland, Greenland, Denmark through Greenland, Siberia through Russia, and Ellesmere Island through Canada, those are areas that can now be used to claim in a country's boundaries to extend to a whole new area. This is an area that's being exposed by melting ice. It's one of the areas of the world that's being exposed most rapidly, and it's the largest territory on the planet that is now open to be contested by countries for mineral and gas resources, for fisheries rights, for sea navigations, and so forth. So it's when we think about the Arctic heating up, think about it politically as much as anything else.
And there's what, a competition, a rush on to what, to claim this land, or is it already staked out?
No, each of the countries is making a claim, and they make a claim to the UN Committee on Law of the Sea. The Russians made theirs, and it was approved geologically. They said yes. The committee says yes, this is a legitimate claim. The Danes and the Canadians make theirs, and theirs are going to be likely approved as well. Now, when they're approved, that doesn't give any country the rights to the areas. It now means the diplomats have to get to work to determine who has those rights and whether they will be exclusive or shared or what have you. But it's an area that we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years. You're going to be reading about it a whole lot more in the newspaper.
And I've got to hit this break here, but I'm just wondering we've had such international cooperation in the Arctic and Antarctica. I was wondering what that means for that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, you can call in with your questions and comments for Neil Shubin. He's a scientist who's worked at the polar regions, exploring, making discoveries about evolution. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, scientist Neil Shubin. His book is Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. If you've got a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255. I have an email question from Bruce. He says, you make reference to DNA as you describe the amphibian-like fossil fish. My understanding is that the fossils are replicas of animal or plant life created naturally by sand silts and seeping into the biological material as the latter deteriorates. How is it that DNA traces could remain from 280 million years ago?
No, that's correct, and that's actually a very good insight. The DNA, so those fossils that we find don't have DNA inside them. What we're doing when we work on genetics is we're comparing the DNA of people, of birds, of frogs, of amphibians that are alive today to fish that are alive today. And by comparing and contrasting creatures that are alive today, we're basically asking the question, how are the genes that build the body of a living fish different from the genes that build the body of a living person? So we're comparing living DNA, not extinct DNA.
All right, and let's go to Paula on the phones. And Paula, you're on the air.
Hi there. As a scientist, how do you deal with religious thoughts about no evolution? How does that play into your the science of what you do?
Well, I mean, it used to be a thing. Hopefully they've forgotten that they're opposed to evolution. But, Neil, how do you deal with that?
I do a lot of speaking in regions of the country that are, profoundly religious and oftentimes, opposed to evolution. And, the way I view myself as a communicator, the way I view myself as a scientist is my job is to tell you, here's what we know. Here's how we know it. This is what the gains are by sticking to the evidence of what we have. And honestly, what I love to do is to tell the story that my colleagues and I designed an expedition to find a fish with arms and legs and lungs and gills. We studied the Earth and its processes to find where the best place to look for them are. And we took a bet. We figured it was in the Arctic. took 6 years to find it, but we found it. And then to show people, here's what we did. This is the prediction we made. This is what we found when we made that prediction. And this is what we tell us about ourselves. Now, some people may choose not to believe that. Others will be excited and believe it, you know. And so, I mean, it's not about belief. It's do you accept the evidence or not? And some people, you know, may not accept the evidence. And there's really kind of not much I can do if people don't want to accept that evidence. But I like to believe that the more I tell the story, the human story of discovery and how we made a prediction and the risks we took to test that prediction and how beautifully that prediction was confirmed, and then actually show the fossil itself, which actually you can clearly see. It has an arm bone. It has, you know, forearm bones, you know, radius and ulna. It has a hip with a femur. You know, that has a power in itself, you know, that actually is more than my own words can ever convey.
There's also the discoveries that have been made working in these extreme regions about human nature, because you have these groups of individuals who are frequently they're quite the characters, and then sometimes they may not do too well working together. You write about how there was an expedition where one Argentine crew member burnt down his Antarctic base after learning he had to overwinter there. One Russian stabbed his Antarctic colleague for spoiling the ending of books.
Yes.
So there are times where, you know, working in close quarters with people, you have psychosis, mutiny, extreme depression, murder happened at these polar sites. And that makes me think about, you know, we're talking about sending people to Mars. I mean, what's, you know, you don't want people having, you know, killing their, you know, fellow cosmonaut because they spoiled the end of the movies, you know. So
now, working in remote environments, in isolation from the rest of humanity, in extreme conditions, can and has driven people mad over time. In fact, one of the challenges is, and for my own expeditions, you know, we might spend 4 to 6 weeks. It's not years, but 4 to 6 weeks. And that can be challenging, too, particularly on those times when we're not finding anything and the weather's terrible. People can really begin to lose focus. And I find the best ways to keep people focused is to focus on their humanity. What do we enjoy? We love good food. Celebrate people. Celebrate their talents. Have a celebration at night with excellent food, even though it takes a lot to get it there very remotely. But, you know, treat people with great respect. Give people space. You know, there are certain things that very successful expeditions to these places have done that have led to success and people getting along. And when things go awry or go south, it's typically they've messed up on some of these more fundamental things.
The creatures that you describe in the book who have natural antifreeze, that they will freeze when the extreme parts of the winter, and then they will thaw themselves and then go about licking the lichen, you know, the rest of the year. That's incredible. Tell us more about that.
Oh, one of the really fun parts of this book for me to write was all the wild and beautiful adaptations that creatures have to survive in these places. One of them is the woolly bear caterpillar, and along with some fish that have they have an antifreeze protein in their body, in their blood, which prevents ice crystals from forming. Or if the ice crystals do form, it prevents them growing large enough to damage their cells. Some worms actually replace all the water in their body with a sugar when the conditions dry out, and they turn into a kind of glass that puts them in suspended animation, sometimes for years at a time, until they're reanimated as the conditions change. I mean, the adaptations we see in some of these creatures are truly remarkable to exist in these places, from going into suspended animation to being able to freeze solid in some cases without any damage to their cells. Some creatures can survive the polar night. You know, remember, it's in these places, it can be dark for 6 months at a time and light for 6 months at a time. Well, most of us are tuned to the light-dark cycle, right? And if we get removed from that, it can damage our health, our mental well-being, and so forth. Well, some creatures can disconnect from that entirely through molecular mechanisms inside the proteins of their body. So it's really remarkable studying what life can do. And in fact, one of the examples that truly blows my mind, and one of the ones that I just loved writing about in the book, is Russian, French, and American teams about 20 years ago were drilling in the center of Antarctica an ice core. And they drilled that core about 2.5 miles below the ice. And what they found below the ice was a lake, a freshwater lake, the size of Lake Superior in the Great Lakes. And when they sampled the water, it turns out it had living creatures inside, microbes. Microbes living under 2.5 miles of ice that had been separated from the surface for a millennia. Whole ecosystems under the ice. And then when satellite technology got advanced enough that they can now see through the ice, they can begin to see that there are about 400 of these special lakes underneath the ice in Antarctica, and these creatures have living, and the lakes have living creatures inside that have been adapting to an area where there's no sunlight. You know, there's very low nutrients. You know, these are creatures that are telling us about what the extremes that life can do and how it can endure, and in fact how life may have arisen or what life may look like if we sample other parts of the solar system. So it's really incredible science.
You write about how there is a littered across the Arctic or meteorites. Is there more likely for them to fall in that area or just be left undisturbed and easier to spot?
Yeah, it's the latter. What happens is meteorites hit all over the Earth. But imagine Antarctica, it's the size, it's ice, larger than the continental United States. Over time, meteorites hit it, but they get buried in the ice. But the ice in Antarctica moves around. It churns about. It moves, as I told you, from the center of the continent to the coast. Well, when that ice hits a barrier like a mountain range, it piles up at the base of the mountain. And sometimes in those pileups, you'll find lots of meteorites. So the actual story is that the ice of Antarctica, under the right conditions, can concentrate meteorites. And so there's teams from the United States and Japan and elsewhere that have been collecting about 50,000 meteorites from the surface of Antarctica for the past several decades. And some of these meteorites are actual pieces of Mars that broke off from the planet during an asteroid impact about 2 billion years ago and then hit the Earth. And they've been a number of them have been found in Antarctica, other places as well.
Which is the theory that these planets have seeded each other with life.
It may have been the case. It may have been the case. We don't know. This is still an open frontier for us to test as scientists. And I think knowing a lot about Antarctica and the Arctic is going to help us understand those frontiers even more.
But just being aware that chunks of Mars and there's probably chunks of Earth that managed to get to Mars, who knows? It's a possibility. Those things happen. And now we have the physical proof of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, this is all stuff to be discovered.
And so do you have more fish that you're looking for that can tell secrets?
Yeah. So what we're doing is we worked there this past summer. We found close relatives of Tiktaalik working in the rocks there. We found, and part of what we want to do is also, it's not just the fish that interests us. It's understanding what are the ecosystems of the world? What did the world look like at the time this momentous event was happening as fish were taking their first steps on land? What were the plants? What were the other animals? What was the temperature? What was the atmosphere? Trying to reconstruct this. And that means knowing a whole lot about the geology. It means knowing a whole lot about studying the chemistry of the rocks and gleaning what information we can gain about ancient environments from that chemistry.
And I wonder, because we have the ice cores. Yeah. The ice cores have a lot of that information. And if they melt, what do we have?
Yeah, we lose a giant library. I mean, ice cores are incredible. Ice, when it melts and when it forms, it's like a library. It holds so much. Inside the ice are, are parts of our past. There's air bubbles that have the atmosphere from thousands of years ago. There's dust from thousands of years ago. And some of this stuff is going to affect our lives. I mean, a Canadian team working a few hundred miles from the North Pole was looking at melting ice. Yeah. And they sampled the waters and they found viruses inside. And they some of those viruses could infect life, and so what's being released by melting ice, are microbes and viruses. In some cases, they've been known to cause infections.
Neil Shubin, his latest book is Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Neil, thank you so much for talking to us. It was fun.
That was great. Thank you for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.